Facebook or Twitter at IAMNIKKISTRONG. I am Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Brian Lin brings us this week's science report. He tells us about new evidence of flooding on Mars. Alice Bryant tells us about recent findings related to COVID-19. We close the show with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first,
the closing of classrooms and the move to online learning during the COVID-19 pandemic has greatly affected students living in rural areas. Silas Castillo is one of them. The 18-year-old lives in Cuba, New Mexico, in a school district on the edge of Native American land that belongs to the Navajo Nation. Like many of his neighbors, Castillo does not have the internet or even electricity. There's not a lot to do here. You clean up, pick up trash, or build stuff, he told the Associated Press. Castillo said he does not like online school. Hopefully, by next semester, we'll be going back into school. I just find it a lot easier and a lot better than just out here, not doing anything, he said. The Cuba Independent School District sits in a village of about 800 people. The district has kept buses running as a way to bring school to students who live in widely separated areas. The buses carry schoolwork, art supplies, and meals. Advisors also use the buses to speak with students who may be struggling with online bullying, abuse, thoughts of suicide, or other problems. The buses are very important for families in the Cuba school district. About half of the students are Hispanic. The other half are Native American, including many Navajo-speaking English language learners. Many families in the area do not have running water. Castillo and others with no electricity charge their school-issued computers with car batteries or at a family member's house. At least one student sends a computer with the buses to be charged at school. Internet service is often either not available or too costly for families living in such rural areas. For students without home internet, the buses bring USB drives loaded with schoolwork and video lessons from teachers. Some students, like Castillo, began asking for schoolwork on paper because of the difficulty of charging computers. With COVID-19 cases increasing in New Mexico to their highest levels yet, it is unclear when the district will restart in-person classes. The district has learned to deal with difficulties. And it has established a good record with graduations, with about 83% of its students finishing high school. That is well above the state average. The district has long used a community school method of helping students. Social workers, nurses, and teachers help students day and night, not just during the school day. The idea is that students will do better in school if their home life can be improved. All students were given computers in 2019, well before the coronavirus health crisis. That made the move to distance learning easier in March when school buildings started shutting down. Before the buses leave Cuba High School each day, about 25 bus drivers and school workers spend over an hour preparing for the trip. They load up milk, fruits and vegetables, prepared meals, toilet paper, and other important necessities. As the bus travels, it passes a home every few kilometers. The Castillos built their home by hand and use a small camper as well. On a recent day, students went out to meet the bus driver, Kelly Mestas. He asked them how they were doing and handed out lunches. Among the students was 15-year-old Autumn Wilson. Her father died after she started high school last year. Then school shut down. Autumn said the sadness over her father's death makes it difficult for her to finish schoolwork. But she looks forward to visits from the bus driver. Kelly, he's really funny to talk to. And if you're feeling sad, you can really talk to him, Autumn said.
People who have had COVID-19 are unlikely to get the disease again for at least 6 months after the first infection, new research suggests. Researchers studied 12,219 British healthcare workers involved in treating people infected with the new coronavirus. COVID-19 is the disease caused by that virus. The findings could be important for tens of millions of people worldwide who have been infected, researchers at the University of Oxford said. This is really good news because we can be confident that, at least in the short term, most people who get COVID-19 won't get it again, said David Eyre. He was one of the leaders of the study. Rare cases of reinfection have caused concern that immunity from the virus might not last and that recovered patients might get sick again. But the results of the study suggest cases of reinfection are likely to remain extremely rare. The study was carried out on healthcare workers who are among those at highest risk of getting COVID-19. Being infected with COVID-19 does offer protection against reinfection for most people for at least 6 months, Eyre said. We found no new symptomatic infections in any of the workers who had tested positive for antibodies. The study is part of a major employee testing program. It covered a 30-week period between April and November 2020. The results have not yet been studied and confirmed by other scientists, but were published early on the website MedArchive. During the study, 89 of 11,052 healthcare workers without antibodies got a new infection with symptoms. However, none of the 1,246 workers with antibodies got a symptomatic infection. The workers with antibodies were also less likely to test positive for COVID-19 without symptoms, the researchers said. 76 of them without antibodies tested positive, compared to 3 with antibodies. Those 3 are all well and did not get COVID-19 symptoms, they added. I'm Alice Bryant.
New research suggests huge floods once flowed through an area on Mars. Scientists say the finding could be a new sign that the planet may have once had the right conditions to support some form of life. The evidence comes from data collected by NASA's Curiosity rover, an exploration vehicle. Curiosity landed on Mars in 2012 and has been exploring the planet's Gale crater ever since. Scientists believe Gale crater was formed when a meteor hit Mars in its early history, about 3.5 to 3.8 billion years ago. Scientists have already collected evidence suggesting that Mars once had a lot of water. In 2015, NASA's Curiosity team said the rover had gathered evidence showing that the red planet could have stored water in large lakes billions of years ago. Last year, European researchers reported that they had discovered the first evidence of a huge groundwater system that once existed below the surface of Mars. Another study from 2019 suggested that Gale crater was also once home to a number of large salty lakes. Scientists have long linked the complex history of water on Mars to whether or not life ever existed on the planet. The evidence that supported the earlier findings is similar to the latest evidence provided by the NASA rover. The data centers on formations made by water and sediment observed by Curiosity in the Gale crater. But the new findings, described in a study appearing in Nature Scientific Reports, suggest that huge megafloods once flowed through the area. Alberto G. Fayeran is a visiting astrobiologist at New York's Cornell University. He helped lead the research and was a co-writer of the study. We identified megafloods for the first time using detailed sedimentological data observed by the rover Curiosity, he said in a statement. Fayeran added that such deposits left behind by megafloods had not been identified by any past Mars observations. The scientists believe the most likely cause of huge Mars flooding was the sudden heat produced by a large impact, the study states. Heat from the meteor hit likely caused melting ice from frozen bodies of water to release carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere. The study suggests this event led to a temporary change on Mars from a cold, dry climate to a warm, wet period. This led to extended, heavy rainfall across the planet. This water, combined with water roaring down from a mountain inside Gale crater, to cause gigantic flash floods, the study said. The evidence includes Curiosity observations of large wave-shaped elements in sedimentary layers of the Gale Crater. The researchers describe these elements as antidunes, small sand hills that form from water flows. The observed antidunes were about 9 meters high and spaced about 137 meters apart, said Izzat Haidari. He is a professor of physics at America's Jackson State University in Mississippi and a co-writer of the study. Haidari said the antidunes are evidence of flowing megafloods at the bottom of the Gale Crater about 4 billion years ago. He noted that they are exactly like elements formed by melting ice on Earth about 2 million years ago. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Abraham Lincoln did not live to see the final surrender of the armies of the Confederacy. A Confederate sympathizer shot the president at Ford's Theater in Washington on April 14, 1865. By that time, however, the American Civil War really was over. General Robert E. Lee surrendered in early April, bringing an end to 4 years of fighting. Several other Confederate armies were still in the field, but they were too small and too weak to continue the fight. Morris Joyce and Leo Scully tell the story of the final surrender of the Confederate armies.
One army was in North Carolina, commanded by General Joe Johnston. 5 days after Lee's surrender, Johnston asked for a meeting with General William Sherman, the commander of Union forces in North Carolina. Sherman met with Johnston a few days later. He offered him the same surrender terms that General Lee had accepted. He said the Confederates must give up their weapons and promise to fight no more. Then they would be free to return to their homes. Johnston said he could not accept these terms. Johnston said he had the power to surrender all the Confederate armies everywhere in the South. He said he would do so if Sherman agreed on a political settlement.
The two generals met again the next day. Sherman listened as Johnston explained his demands. Most of them Sherman accepted. He believed that President Lincoln wanted to help the South as much as possible. He had heard Lincoln say that he wanted to make it easy for the Southern states to return to the Union. When the agreement was completed, Sherman sent it immediately to Washington for approval by the new president, Andrew Johnson. The agreement seemed to give the South everything it wanted.
Instead of surrendering to Sherman, the Confederate armies would break up. The soldiers would return to their homes, taking their weapons with them. They would sign a promise not to fight again and to obey state and federal laws. In exchange for this, Sherman said the president would recognize state governments in the South which promised to support the Constitution. He said federal courts would be established in the South again. And he said the president, as well as he could, would protect the political rights promised to all people by the Constitution of the United States and the state constitutions. And Sherman said the United States government would not interfere with any of the Southern people if they remained peaceful and obeyed the laws.
President Johnson held a cabinet meeting to discuss the agreement Sherman had signed. War Secretary Stanton and the other members of the cabinet were violently opposed to it. They said Sherman had no power to make any kind of political settlement. President Johnson rejected the agreement. He said Johnston's army must surrender within 48 hours or be destroyed. He said the surrender terms could be no better than those given General Lee.
Johnston decided to surrender. On April 26th, his army laid down its weapons. One by one, the remaining armies surrendered. The soldiers began returning home. Many of them were bitter. They wanted to continue to fight. They spoke of guerrilla war against the Yankees. But most of the Confederate commanders opposed this. Many, like Cavalry General Nathan Bedford Forrest, urged their men to accept defeat. Said Forrest, in a farewell speech to his men, "It is a clear fact that we are beaten. We would be foolish to try to fight further. The government which we tried to establish is at an end. Civil war, such as you have just passed through, naturally causes feelings of bitterness and hatred. We must put these feelings aside. Whatever your responsibilities may be, meet them like men. You have been good soldiers. You can be good citizens."
Confederate President Jefferson Davis fled south after the fall of his government. He hoped to get across the Mississippi River. He believed that he could form a new Confederate army. If this failed, he planned to escape to Mexico. President Lincoln had hoped that Davis would escape. He felt that punishing Davis would only create more bitterness and make Reconstruction, the rebuilding of the South, more difficult. But President Johnson did not share Lincoln's feelings. He believed Davis had a part in the plot to kill Lincoln. He said, "Davis must be captured." On May 10th, Union forces found the Confederate president's camp in southern Georgia. They seized him and took him to Fort Monroe, Virginia. He remained there for many months under close guard. His trial was never held. And finally, in 1867, he was freed.
Late in May, 150,000 Union soldiers, representing every one of the Union armies, came to Washington. They came to take part in a big parade, a victory march through the city. For 2 days, the soldiers marched past the White House. Many of the marching men had fought at Bull Run, at Fredericksburg, Antietam, Gettysburg, Petersburg, and Appomattox. Sherman's Western Army was there from battles at Shiloh, Vicksburg, Murfreesboro, Chickamauga, and Atlanta. The soldiers marched proudly past the president and other government leaders.
along the way, from the Capitol building to the White House, were huge crowds of cheering people. Hour after hour, the soldiers passed. Never had the city seen such a celebration. Each group of soldiers had its band and carried its own battle flags. Some proudly carried flags that had been torn in fierce fighting. Finally, late on the second day, the final group of soldiers passed the White House. The grand parade was over. The battle flags were put away, and the marching bands fell silent. The war was ended. Now, men could look about them and count the cost of the war.
4 years of bloody fighting had saved the Union of States. The Northern victory had settled for all time the question of whether states could leave the Union. And it had put to rest the great problem of slavery, which had troubled the nation for so many years. But the costs were great. More than 600,000 men of the North and South lost their lives. Hundreds of thousands more were wounded. Many had lost their arms or legs.
The war cost the North almost $3,500,000,000. It was almost as costly to the Confederates. Most of the war was fought in the southern states, and most of the war damage was there. Hundreds of cities and towns suffered damage. Some, like Atlanta, were completely destroyed by Union forces. The damage outside the populated areas was almost as great. Union armies had marched across the South, leaving behind them widespread destruction. Farmhouses and buildings had been burned, animals and crops seized or destroyed.
Transport in the South was especially hard hit. Union soldiers had destroyed most of the railroads. The few Confederate trains that escaped capture were worn out from heavy use. Riverboats had been destroyed, and roads and bridges were in terrible condition. The South had no money to rebuild. Businessmen and rich landowners had put their money in Confederate bonds, now completely worthless. Confederate war debts would never be paid. There was also the question of the 4 million former slaves. They were free now, but few could take care of themselves. They needed jobs and training.
The people of the South faced a difficult future. They had been defeated in battle. Their economy was destroyed. In many areas, there was little food, and the people were hungry. Farmers could not plant crops because they had no seed and no animals to break the ground. There was no money for rebuilding. To add to all these problems, radical Republicans in Washington were demanding severe punishment for the South. Instead of offering aid, they demanded that the government sell the property of Southerners to pay Union war debts.
President Andrew Johnson, himself a Southerner from Tennessee, opposed the radical plans. He had his own program of reconstruction for the South.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.